Welcome to the Nutrition Science Podcast, where we help you cut through the noise and make informed, science-based decisions about nutrition and your health.
Welcome back to another episode of the Nutrition Science Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian Chavez, and in this episode, we're going to be talking about plant toxins and anti-nutrients. So if you haven't heard these terms before, these have been made popular by individuals who are proponents of an animal-based or carnivore diet. So people who are promoting to avoid plant foods, and this is one of the justifications that they're using, is that plant foods have these plant toxins and anti-nutrients that are having a negative impact on our health. So what we're going to do in this episode is I'm going to discuss what those plant toxins and anti-nutrients are and what their actual effects are in our bodies, because there is some truth to some of the claims that are being made around the potentially harmful effects of some of these compounds. So it is something that I think is worth discussing in more detail. So that's what we're going to do in this episode. Before we get started, I want to thank those of you who have left reviews. We're at right about 300 reviews on both Spotify and Apple. So if some of you who are listening who enjoy the podcast and want to go leave a review, want to go stop the episode right now, or you don't even have to pause it, you can keep listening to it and go over to your phone and leave a review. That would be greatly appreciated so we could get over 300. I really enjoy seeing these reviews come in. There's a few that have come in recently. There was MT Bike 80304. It says, as a scientist myself, I really enjoy this podcast. I appreciate the format and the review of the current literature on questions related to nutrition. Another one was from Girl RDN. LD, which is registered dietitian nutritionist. So this individual is a dietitian. And so she says, I'm a registered dietitian and I really appreciate, enjoy, and look forward to this podcast. He provides evidence-based nutrition on many interesting and current topics. His guests are experts in their fields and there's no quackery here. Also enjoy the mini episodes and the more in-depth ones. So I love seeing scientists, physicians, registered dietitians, and everyone else who are listening to the show and getting value from it. As I see these reviews come in from other healthcare professionals, it really does validate what I'm doing and what I'm trying to do with this podcast is really provide a trusted resource. And I know everyone says that, but my goal at the end of the day is to create an archive of nutrition information that I can just send people to and they can learn about information that is going to empower you to improve your health. So I am really appreciative for those of you who are leaving reviews and who have already left reviews. We are just about to cross 300 reviews and the podcast continues to grow very quickly. And I've been saying that every week, but every time I look at the stats, I'm expecting it to start to drop down and it continues to increase. And I really appreciate all of you for sharing the podcast, for leaving reviews, and helping to spread the message. So thank you so much for that. If you haven't checked out the new podcast website, I would recommend doing that. So thenutritionsciencepodcast.com. If you go there, you'll be able to search all of the episodes. And then you can also find links to any of the information that we discuss. You can find the studies that I'm citing in each podcast episode. You can also find links to any supplements I recommend or any other products. So I recommend checking that out and using that as a resource to help you jump around and find the right information. Like if you're trying to find an episode, if you wanted to see if I had an episode on collagen, you can go there and you can search for it. Unfortunately, Spotify, Apple don't allow for that function, but if you go to the podcast website, you will be able to do that. So I recommend checking that out. With that said, let's go ahead and jump into the content of the show. So what are anti-nutrients? So there are various things that are classified as anti-nutrients or quote unquote plant toxins. I don't even like using these terms. You'll hear why, but they are lectins, oxalates, phytates, goitrogens, phytoestrogens, and tannins. And there's some other things that could potentially be classified, but these are the main ones that we are consuming in our diet that seem to be potentially problematic. So the first one that we're going to talk about is lectins. Lectins are found primarily in legumes, so beans, lentils. We'll also find them in grains and seeds, and then also nuts to a lesser extent. There's over 500 different types of lectins. They all have different functions in the plant. These are proteins that can bind to different types of carbohydrates, like very specifically bind to carbohydrates to influence the function of that particular molecule that it's binding to. So in plants, these lectins serve as a defense mechanism, and the thought process is that when we consume them, they have negative effects on our body. Now, the reality is that there's so many different types of lectins. Some of them can have potentially negative effects in our body. Some of them we've identified to have serious negative effects in our body, such as the lectins found in red kidney beans that we know can be deadly if we consume them raw. But we also know that some of these lectins have positive effects in our body, and some of them are actually being isolated as treatments for various diseases. So when we talk about lectins, we are talking about a variety of different compounds that may have positive or negative effects in our body depending on the type of lectin that we're consuming and the dose that we're consuming it in. The good news is that when we are eating a varied diet and when we're cooking our food, and also when we're talking about like beans and whole grains, if you're cooking it, if you're soaking it, if you're fermenting these foods, all of these things significantly reduce the amount of lectins that are found in those foods. In animal studies, high amounts of isolated lectins have been shown to have potentially negative effects on the GI tract. So one of the things that you'll hear people say is that lectins can damage the gut and lead to leaky gut. This is animal studies that have used isolated doses of single lectins in very high doses. This doesn't happen when we're actually eating the foods. When we're eating the foods, and if they've been soaked, let's say, for example, you had beans, you soaked it, you rinsed it, you cooked it, almost no lectins are present in the final product that you're consuming. So you're going to have very low exposure to lectins, and that low exposure is going to have no negative effect on your health. Most likely going to have a positive effect on your health because of foods that contain lectins, such as beans, whole grains, seeds, nuts, have all shown to have beneficial effects on our health when we look at randomized controlled trials and population studies of people who eat more of these. So I mentioned nuts and seeds. The lectin content of nuts and seeds is a little bit lower than what you're going to get from some beans and whole grains. And with the beans and whole grains, it's really just, you know, soaking and cooking. You're going to remove most of the lectins. If you want to ferment these things, because some people will consume fermented beans, that will reduce lectin content even further, but that's not necessary. Now, if you do experience digestive issues when you consume these foods, then it may be, you know, something that you can explore further of removing them or using various types of cooking methods, you know, the soaking, the fermenting, the cooking. Pressure cooking can also reduce lectin content even further, and going through these more drastic measures to reduce lectin content as much as you possibly can. But most people, 99% of the population, is not experiencing negative issues from lectin consumption in a normal varied diet. Now, if your diet is consisting of very, very high amounts of beans, and you're not cooking them very well, and you're not soaking them, and you're having exposure to high amounts of lectins because you're eating lots of beans and whole grains, and you're not going through these extra steps to reduce lectin content, and then you have a predisposition to having a negative reaction to these things, then maybe they can be problematic for you. But this isn't the case for the vast majority of people. And there are people who have written entire books around these topics. Like, for example, there's a guy named Dr. Stephen Gundry, who wrote a book called The Plant Paradox, who tried to make lectins out to be this incredibly harmful thing. This is not the case. These foods that contain lectins are associated with positive health outcomes, have shown to have positive effects on our health when we eat them, and the lectin content of these foods is significantly reduced when we cook these foods, and at the levels that we are going to be exposed to lectins to in the context of a normal varied diet, they are not an issue. And so this isn't something that people really need to be worried about. Again, if you are in a unique situation where you have digestive or autoimmune issues and you realize that you have a negative reaction to some of these foods, then that might be something to explore further. But for the average person, this is not an issue. Okay. Next thing is oxalates. So oxalates can bind to minerals like sodium, potassium, calcium, iron, and magnesium and reduce their absorption. They can also build up in the kidney, and they can contribute to the development of what are called calcium oxalate kidney stones. So oxalates can do this. They interfere with mineral absorption. You know, you'll hear some people say they block or they destroy mineral absorption. That's not the case. They can bind to some of those minerals, and they'll reduce absorption to a certain degree depending on the amount of oxalates that you're consuming. And they can increase when you're consuming high amounts of oxalates. in certain circumstances, they can increase the risk of kidney stones. And we'll talk about what those circumstances are in a second. Okay. Now, the main sources of oxalates are going to be spinach, chard, cashews, almonds, wheat bran, and other foods can have a lesser extent as well. Now, oxalates in these foods can be reduced by over 50% by cooking these foods. And specifically, like with spinach and other greens, if you boil them in water, you will reduce oxalate content by over 80%. So you can still take advantage of some of the nutrition. Plus, these foods are more nutritious when they're cooked anyways. So if you boil spinach in water for a couple of minutes and then drain it, you're actually going to increase the nutritional content or the bioavailability of the nutrients in the spinach, and then you'll reduce the oxalate content by over 80%. So we can reduce the oxalate content significantly in these foods by cooking them. And when we look at these foods that contain high oxalate content, they're also very nutritious foods. So like spinach, for example, spinach is one of the most nutritious foods on the planet. It has a variety of different nutrients that we'll get when we consume spinach. So a lot of people will fearmonger around oxalate, saying that spinach will reduce the absorption of some minerals. But the reality is spinach is providing lots of nutrition as well. So we have to look at the larger context. So spinach, yes, is providing some oxalates that will reduce the absorption of some minerals, but it's one of the most nutritious foods on the planet. And so at the same time, it's also providing lots of quality nutrition. Now, we also have to take into consideration the kidney stones. When it comes to kidney stones, when people are consuming sufficient amounts of calcium, there is no relationship between oxalate consumption and the development of kidney stones. So oxalate absorption is going to be higher when calcium consumption is low. And when calcium consumption is low, there'll be more oxalates that are absorbed, and that can contribute to an increased likelihood of the development of kidney stones. But a low calcium diet will increase the likelihood of the development of kidney stones anyway, and it is advised to consume enough calcium, not only for reducing the risk of developing kidney stones, but also for bone health and overall health. So it's just essential to ensure that you're consuming enough calcium. It's not that you need to avoid oxalates. It's that oxalates can be problematic in the context of a low calcium diet. And a low calcium diet is not something that you want to be following anyway. So ensuring that you're consuming enough calcium is more important than avoiding the oxalates. So from that perspective, now, if you are someone who has a history of calcium oxalate kidney stones, and or you currently do have calcium oxalate kidney stones, you have a history of that. In this case, yes, it's going to make sense to reduce and minimize oxalate consumption to prevent future episodes and just be safe. But for the general population, you'll hear people talk about this relationship between oxalates and kidney stones that can occur in susceptible individuals who have low calcium intake, and they'll apply it to the whole population, and they'll try to tell you to avoid spinach because spinach has oxalates and it binds to minerals and it increases the risk of kidney stones. But the reality is it binds to some minerals to a small degree, but we can reduce that oxalate content by over 50% by cooking it. It's also a very nutritious food, and the risk of it contributing to kidney stones is only present when someone is not consuming enough calcium. So this isn't something that we really need to worry about when it comes to oxalates. Make sure you're consuming enough calcium. And if you're eating spinach or other greens that are very high in oxalates on a regular basis, make sure you're cooking them. The best method to reduce oxalate content is to boil them in water and then drain them. Next, we're going to talk about goitrogens. These are compounds that can interfere with the absorption of iodine. And as a result of that, they can impact thyroid function because iodine is very important for thyroid function. These goitrogens are found primarily in cruciferous vegetables. And like most of you who listen to this podcast know, cruciferous vegetables are very nutritious. So again, we have to consider the context here. So these goitrogens can interfere with iodine absorption. And at very high levels in animal studies, they've been shown to potentially cause problems with thyroid function due to this effect. However, when we're consuming a mixed diet of normal cruciferous vegetables that most people are eating regularly, your exposure to these goitrogenic compounds is going to be very low. And in that context, there has been no relationship between the consumption of cruciferous vegetables and thyroid function. With that being said, there are potential cases where high consumption of some of these foods could cause problems. And there are case studies where people have eaten very high amounts of these goitrogenic foods and caused problems with their thyroid. However, this is mainly going to be with consumption of the highest goitrogen containing foods, and that is Russian kale, broccoli rabe, and collard greens. So if you're going to be eating these foods on a regular basis, try to cook them in water with iodized salt. Now, if you do have thyroid issues, it might be best to just avoid these three. But avoiding all of the cruciferous vegetables doesn't make sense. All of the other ones have much lower levels of goitrogenic compounds, and the association between consuming those other cruciferous vegetables and the development or the worsening of any thyroid disease hasn't been shown. And so there's no evidence that has supported that. Again, we have to take into context what we're looking at here. So these goitrogenic compounds, yes, they can have this effect, but they only have this effect when we eat high amounts of them. And we also have to consider that these goitrogenic compounds are coming along with very nutritious cruciferous vegetables, and the health benefits of consuming these cruciferous vegetables outweighs the potential risks of these small amounts of goitrogenic compounds that are found in them. So that's the goitrogenic compounds, or goitrogens, as you might hear them called. The next thing that we're going to discuss is phytoestrogens. These phytoestrogenic compounds are primarily found in soy and soy products, along with flax seeds. And these compounds have a chemical structure that is very similar to estrogen. And the thought process is that these phytoestrogenic compounds can stimulate estrogen receptors and lead to negative effects associated with excess estrogen, and also in men lead to like a feminizing effect. None of this is actually shown in human studies with consumption of these compounds. So when we consume phytoestrogenic compounds, they can bind to estrogen receptors, but they also prevent the endogenous estrogen from binding. And the endogenous estrogen is actually a more potent estrogenic compound. And so when you prevent the binding of a more potent compound, you reduce the estrogenic effect. And so it's a little bit complicated, but essentially these compounds can come in, and yes, they have a very similar structure to estrogen, but they can bind to estrogen receptors and prevent estrogen from binding and actually have a anti-estrogen type of effect in some cases. And so when we look at the data on consumption of these compounds and health outcomes, it's all positive. In animal studies that use very high concentrations, they've shown negative effects, but in human studies with regular consumption, all of the effects of phytoestrogenic compounds, of consuming phytoestrogenic compounds in both men and women, have shown to be positive. A lot of people get worried about this because they hear the term estrogen and they think that it's going to, in men, it's going to cause you to become feminized, and in women, it's going to contribute to symptoms and hormone imbalances and things like that. None of this is actually true. When we eat foods that contain phytoestrogens, the effects are all positive. And I might do a whole episode on tofu and soy, because that is one of the biggest perpetual myths in nutrition, is that they're harmful and they disrupt hormones and they contribute to cancer. And it couldn't be further from the truth. Soy consumption and tofu consumption and soy derivatives have shown only positive effects in pretty much every study when it comes to cancer risk, when it comes to heart disease risk, when it comes to symptoms of PMS for women, symptoms of menopause for women, no negative hormonal effects in men. It's all positive. And so again, I might actually break down that research just to have that to refer to, because I know that's been a perpetual myth for years. It's something that I believed at one point, and it's just not true at all. So let's get on to the next anti-nutrient, and that's phytates. So phytates are a energy storage unit in plants, and these phytates can bind to copper, calcium, zinc, and iron, and they can prevent their absorption. But phytic acid is also a potent antioxidant. So on one hand, this compound prevents the absorption of important minerals. On the other hand, this compound is an antioxidant. We can reduce phytate levels through cooking, fermenting, soaking, etc., primarily found in whole grains, beans, lentils, nuts, and seeds, and other pseudo-grains like quinoa. And these phytates, we can reduce their amount by cooking them. We can reduce it by about 25-ish percent. But the reality is, like I said a second ago, we haven't shown any negative effects of consuming phytates on a regular basis. We know that they can potentially interfere with mineral absorption, but we can also reduce their content by soaking, fermenting, cooking, just like with lectins. So it's very similar to with lectins. Phytates and lectins kind of come alongside each other, and they are reduced in similar ways as well. So they're found in some of the same foods. They're reduced in similar ways. So you can reduce the amount of lectins and phytates in a lot of these foods by going through those same cooking and preparation methods. Now, when it comes to phytates, there hasn't been any negative effects shown of consuming foods high in phytates. Again, just like with lectins, these foods have other beneficial health effects. And as I mentioned a second ago, the phytic acid itself acts as an antioxidant. So we don't know, there's a balance because it's interfering with mineral absorption to a certain extent, because they can interfere with mineral absorption to a certain extent, but they're also providing minerals, and they're also, the phytic acid itself is an antioxidant. So not something to worry about. Again, the phytic acid, phytates, not something to worry about. Lectins, I would say lectins are more of a concern if you're someone with digestive or autoimmune issues because of the way that they can interact with the immune system. But phytates don't do that. Phytates just can interfere with mineral absorption. And that's really the only potential issue there. And this is why it's important to just eat a nutritious diet. And the phytates themselves, the foods that contain the phytates, are going to provide some of that nutrition as well. And if you're eating those foods alongside other nutritious foods, yes, the absorption of some of those minerals is going to be reduced, but you're still going to absorb the rest of them, and you're still going to get the benefits of that. So if you're eating a diverse diet, if you're eating a nutritious diet, this isn't something to really worry too much about. The last thing that we're going to discuss is tannins. And tannins are found in chocolate and tea and dark colored fruits and fruit juices, and then to a smaller extent in some nuts and seeds and legumes. And tannins can interfere with the absorption of iron, copper, and zinc. However, tannins are also very powerful antioxidant nutrients, and they possess a range of beneficial health properties. So this is, again, one of these double-edged swords. So you'll hear people talk about one side of it. You'll hear people say that they interfere with the absorption of various minerals if they're trying to scare you away from eating plant foods. But you won't hear the other side of it, of there's also basically a range of health benefits associated with consuming these nutrients. And in animal studies and cell culture studies and human studies, these nutrients have shown positive health effects. Like, for example, EGCG, you may have heard of this. This is a compound that's found in green tea. This is a tannin, and this can interfere with the absorption of those minerals. However, every study that's ever been done has shown positive effects of green tea on blood glucose control, on long-term health outcomes, on cancer risk, on diabetes risk, on heart disease risk. So should we avoid tannins because they interfere with mineral absorption? No, we need to look at the greater picture. And that's really the case with all of these quote-unquote anti-nutrients, is there's a little smidget of truth there that is completely taken out of context. And this information is used to manipulate your dietary choices in a way that isn't actually beneficial for you, because someone can zero in on these quote-unquote anti-nutrients and make you think that you shouldn't be eating lectins, you shouldn't be eating phytates, you shouldn't be eating tannins, and you have to avoid these foods. And then so you start to avoid whole grains, you start to avoid beans, you start to avoid nuts and seeds. And all of these foods have shown nothing but positive health effects in every study that's been done on them. There is not research that shows that consuming more nuts has a negative effect on health. Now, there may be certain circumstances where people may have sensitivities and immunological reactions to various nuts where cutting them out may have a benefit to that individual. However, in general, the consumption of quote-unquote anti-nutrients and plant toxins have a positive effect on health, and the foods that contain them have a positive effect on health. And so there's a book called The Plant Paradox, there's another book called The Carnivore Code, and there's many others that have been written that have taken this information, that have exaggerated this information completely, that have taken it out of context and used it to scare people away from eating certain plant foods and thinking that these plant foods are going to have a harmful effect on their health, when that's not at all the case. We have to look at the greater context, and the greater context is when we consume foods that are high in phytates, lectins, oxalates, phytoestrogens, etc., they have a positive effect on our health. So there are some nuances. Like I discussed in this episode, oxalates in certain cases may be problematic. Lectins in certain cases may be problematic. If you're eating very high amounts of these and you're not eating a very nutritious diet overall outside of these foods, that may lead to mineral absorption and nutrient inadequacy, and that could be potentially problematic in some cases. But overall, trying to think about and avoid foods that contain these quote-unquote plant toxins and anti-nutrients is not a good use of your time when it comes to nutrition. That is not going to benefit your health. So I hope this episode was helpful. Please send this to anyone who starts to talk about these topics to you. I'm going to cite a couple studies in the show notes, and there's going to be a couple reviews of these topics. So it's going to be thorough reviews of the literature on these various topics. So if you want to read more and you want to understand these topics in greater depth than we discussed here, highly recommend checking out those studies. So I'm going to post them in the show notes. Again, you can find them at the podcast website, thenutritionsciencepodcast.com. If you go there, click on the show, you'll find the information there as well. But you can also find them in the show notes on Spotify or Apple, and then you can click on those, read through them. Really good reads if you really want to understand this topic better. If you're a practitioner in this space, and this is a topic that people are coming to you with and asking you questions about, you can refer them to this podcast, but it would also help to read those studies. So I would recommend reading those papers, you know, giving yourself 30, 45 minutes, sit down, read through them. It'll help you understand this topic a lot better, and it'll help you serve your clients a lot better if this is something that you currently don't feel very comfortable discussing and you can't explain very well. All right, so that's all I have for this episode. I hope you all have a great week, and we will talk soon.